The next case is 08-2097, Trumbull County Bar Association versus George Nicholas Cafanteras. Mr. Hollister.
Good morning, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, Honorable Justices, may it please the court. My name is John Hollister. With Mr. Mark Cafanteras, I'm representing the respondent in this matter, George Cafanteras. I request to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. I want to thank the court for offering me the opportunity, the privilege of appearing before you in this matter. We are here objecting to the proposed findings of fact, conclusions of law, and recommendations of the Board of Commissioners. We are objecting to one actual matter stated by the board, which is the proposed sanction. The board recommended disbarment. We are requesting that this court impose instead an indefinite suspension. In supporting its recommendation of disbarment, the board relied on a section called mitigating and aggravating factors drawn from section 10 of the regulations for proceedings before the board. And in that mitigating and aggravating section, there is an inconsistency. The board stated at page 17 of its report that we find most of the aggravating factors to be present without the existence of any recognized mitigation. And it stated the following elements of aggravation are present. Number four, lack of cooperation in the disciplinary process. That statement actually contradicts statements it made previously in the same report on page 9 and on the bottom of page 12 and the top of page 13, when it specifically said, the panel finds that there is not clear and convincing evidence that respondent violated government of the bar rule 5-4G, and with respect both to count 1 and count 2, dismisses that allegation. And the board adopted the panel recommendation in full, so that also became the finding of the board. So you have, in the two places where it was a matter of substance, the board, through the panel, saying there is no sufficient evidence of failure to cooperate, but then coming in at the end, unsupported, saying, well, it's an aggravating factor that there was no cooperation. And we believe that that inconsistency probably arises from some sort of inartful drafting, and it would be proper for this court to follow the more specific findings on pages 9 and 12 and 13, that there was insufficient evidence of failure to cooperate. We also disagree with the board's statement that there were no mitigating factors. If you look at section 10 of the regulation B2C, repayment is a mitigating factor. The board does not discuss the fact that there was evidence in the record that under both counts 1 and 2, repayment has been made. In section 10B2D, full and free disclosure to the board, a cooperative attitude is stated to be a mitigating factor. Mr. Cafanteras, from the beginning of these proceedings, has admitted that he committed the conduct charged. He has never denied that, and therefore we think the board was in error in not noting that as a mitigating factor. Section 10B2G of the regulation refers to the potential mitigating factor of mental disability. There's evidence in the record involving a diagnosis of depression. There are four subparagraphs under that 10B2G. Subparagraph 1 and 2 are present in this case, and we also would ask the court to look into the record. There was a testimony of a Dr. Narayan that the hearing panel refused to entertain. It was proffered. Since Dr. Narayan is an expert, we would ask the court to examine that proffer.
Why did they refuse to entertain it again?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Why did they refuse to entertain his testimony?
Dr. Narayan had read the report. Dr. Narayan is a psychiatrist who works for the PsyCare entity in Youngstown. He had, prior to giving his deposition, read the report of the director of PsyCare, who is a clinical psychologist. And in the court handling of their cases, they are accustomed to communicate and cooperate. Each within his own discipline, the clinical psychologist tends to reach the diagnoses of mental problems and conditions. The psychiatrist undertakes the specific treatment, especially where that treatment involves medication. So they are part of a team that the PsyCare entity applies to their clients, patients. The last two subparagraphs, small Roman numeral 3 and small Roman numeral 4 of section 10b2g, having to do with the mitigating factor of mental disability. The first two, we believe there's evidence in the record, they exist at this time. There has been a diagnosis. There is treatment being applied. The last two are actually matters that cannot be determined until sometime in the future. How this treatment will be effective, what will happen over the course of time, and the final conclusion, can somebody come in and say, we believe that this man can indeed practice law without presenting a danger to the public. That's one of the reasons we're asking for an indefinite suspension rather than disbarment. Indefinite suspension does not mean that he will ever in fact reapply, and even if he were, it certainly does not mean he'll be readmitted. That's a matter of your discretion, and at any some future date when he did apply, you would have to review basically the entire process that you would have on somebody applying for admission the first time. The Bar Association would have the opportunity to make any objections it wished to at that point. And you, even if you then were to make the leap of readmitting him, you could readmit him with virtually any conditions you wish to impose, such as continued treatment, mentorship, supervision of his financial accounting, and so on. But where two of the four factors under this paragraph simply cannot be established with definiteness until sometime in the future, it seems more prudent to delay their consideration rather than today to pretermit them by prejudging in advance, well, they will never be established, they can never be established, so we are now going to make the ultimate foreclosing decision of disbarment. On the importance of repayment as a factor in mitigation, I've called the court's attention to the recent case of Cleveland Bar Association versus Mishler that's cited in the brief. Another very important factor, which the board did not address in the least, but which there is testimony in the record to support, is where there is no resulting harm to the clients. Two cases discuss that specifically, Disciplinary Council versus Clayton and the Dayton Bar Association versus Rogers. In this case, as far as Ms. Heasley's concerned, she's received her money. She's been made whole. As far as the Williams estate is concerned, that money has never been disbursed. It's still in the hands of Mr. Kelliger. And interestingly, when and if it is ultimately disbursed to the beneficiaries, that money paid Mr. Kelliger by Mr. Caventaris is the only recovery the people will ever make, because the balance of the estate has been embezzled by a defaulting fiduciary.
Well, when a client is, when money is withheld or taken or not properly accounted for to a client, but the lawyer then later makes restitution, that the client's been harmed, haven't they?
I cannot remember off the top of my head if it was Clayton or Rogers. there was a specific case where the court noted that there was an identifiable proximately caused resulting harm. In the case I'm thinking of, it's one of these cited, a member of the family wished to go to college. His entry into college was delayed for 2 years because they did not have the money to pay the tuition, and they did not have the money to pay the tuition because the lawyer had retained the funds. That type of proximate resulting harm does not exist in this case. As I say, in the Williams estate, the money's still there undispersed. They haven't settled the estate. In the Heasley case, Ms. Heasley's gotten her money, probably is gone, but she was receiving money continuously, and she has now received all of it. So there's nothing in the record to show an actual consequent event of harm resulting from not having this money at a specific identifiable moment in time. Yes, there is a broad policy concern about not delaying the payment of the money. That's why commingling is such a grave matter, and that's why we're here today. That's the reason for the rule in the first place. So there is no question that there is, but Mr. Cafantaris has admitted all the way through, he is guilty of the charges of commingling. That's in effect included in the matters brought before the court.
But counsel, but for the disciplinary action, there would not have been restitution made here, correct?
There has been no evidence that that's the case. Mr. Cafantaris' own testimony is he always intended to repay the money.
That didn't happen, though, until the disciplinary process was in place.
No, the disciplinary proceedings were not instituted until, as my recollection, until after the repayment had actually been made.
However, if Ms. Heasley had asked for all of her money at a specific point in time, it would not have been
there. That is correct.
So it was fortuitous for your client, or fortunate for your client, that that was the case. I mean, he was paying certain portions of the money to her, but at any one point in time, there was a discrepancy because he had been commingling.
And that is the substance of the charges, and Mr. Cafantaris has admitted that. The importance of being actively involved in mental health treatment as a mitigating factor is the subject of Toledo Bar Association versus Kramer. The board did not deal with that in any substance.
But there is a finding that his depression and his mental health issues did not contribute to the misconduct.
I think that's overstating the case, Your Honor. The testimony of the psychologist, which is what the board had before it and therefore had available to consider, was that the mental condition the psychologist found and diagnosed was consistent with this behavior. And I'm not sure that people in that business actually go any further than that and state that more definitely in most cases. And finally, as in the case of disciplinary counsel versus Gradina, Mr. Cafantaris is actively involved in a contract with the Ohio Lawyers Assistance Program, and the record has been successfully supplemented with reports from that agency. So you do have those available to you.
Mr. Hollister, has restitution been made in the case of the Heasley representation in full?
Yes, in both cases.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hollister. Mr. Redlove.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, Mr. Hollister. I have seated at the table with me today Kurt Ambrosi, who worked with me and I with him in the prosecution of this grievance. Mr. Hollister and I agree on one thing in this case, and that is that there is no dispute as to what Mr. Cafantaris did over the course of several years, and the question is that of penalty. I think it's important for this court to recall that in May of 2003, it suspended Mr. Cafantaris for fraud, dishonesty, deceit, misrepresentation, conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice, knowingly concealing and failing to disclose that which he was obligated to disclose. As an officer of the court, as a lawyer, as a defendant in a civil sexual harassment case by one of his former employees. He lied under oath in a deposition and in an affidavit, and also lied in an answer. Only after he was caught by DNA evidence did he then admit what he had done. In that case, he presented mitigation evidence that he had cooperated. He stipulated to all of his misconduct. He did not do that here. He wouldn't stipulate to anything in this case. In the other case, a trial judge testified on his behalf. He couldn't find one within 100 miles to help him this time. Fellow lawyers supported him. Nobody would come forward. This court said in that case, respect for the law and our legal system is the sine qua non of the right to continuance on the roles of a lawyer, and that the disciplinary rules and ethical considerations are founded on respect for the law, the court system, the judges, counsel, and most of all, clients. Now, what did Mr. Cafenteras learn from his first suspension? Because after that suspension was imposed, or when he knew it was at least coming, he took $25,000 from a dead woman and didn't tell her family or the probate court. And what's worse, he took that money while his first case was pending before this court. He then gave this court an affidavit after he was suspended saying, I've complied with the order that you imposed upon me to fully account to my clients for the money that I was holding. I filed notices of disqualification in all of my cases. And we know now from his own admitted testimony, he didn't do any of that. And to this day, he has never come back to this court and said, you know what, I was wrong, okay? He hasn't tried to correct that. He hasn't expressed any remorse for it. He took $36,000 that we can establish for sure from Irene Heasley. And in all due respect, Mr. Hollister, all that money has not been paid back.
What is the amount owed?
There's an excess of $9,000, Your Honor. What Mr. Cafenteras did was come up with a whole series of checks that we don't argue went to this lady. But there was $9,000 unaccounted for. And he said, well, I gave her $1,000 here and I bought groceries there. She denied that. She said she didn't get that.
Has the IOLTA account been examined?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, the IOLTA account was an absolute shambles. It took us over a year from the time we first requested information from Mr. Cafenteras to get anything. And then what we got was incomprehensible. And even today, we don't know for sure whose money he used to give money to Irene Heasley, because as of September, I believe 2005, or 2006, excuse me, when this came to our attention, there should have been in excess of $30,000 in that account. It was down to like $95. So after that point, he continued to give her money, but from what source, we couldn't identify because he didn't have any records. He couldn't tell us where that money came from. He couldn't tell us whose money was in the account. He testified in deposition, and I believe at the hearing, that he kept all these records in his head. So we don't know. He, in fact, did refuse to cooperate with our investigation. It took us more than 10 months to get his IOLTA account records. The fact that the board chose not to make a finding on that point, I think, was more a sign of compassion for the terrible circumstances he was already in than to say he did nothing wrong. This man tried to justify what he did to the newspaper by saying, maybe we didn't follow the rules. Yes, there was some dipping. Yes, there was some commingling, but there was some benefit. How could there have been benefit? He used his privilege, practice law, to take money that didn't belong to him and to lie to this court.
Would you address the mental health issues?
Because I would be happy to, Your Honor.
I got them. First of all, I don't quite understand from the answer why the psychiatrist was not allowed to testify.
Well,
I understand there was something.
That is not true. The psychiatrist did testify.
And then the record seems to say that the psychiatrist said it was not related to his conduct.
That's absolutely correct. What happened was the relator completed its case, I believe, in early April. We could have done the whole case in one day had there been stipulations, but there weren't. So we finished our case. Mr. Cafenteras then ran to a place called Psych Care, talks to Dr. Darnell, who's a psychologist, and he also gets hooked up with Dr. Narayan, who is a psychiatrist. Both of those professionals had their depositions taken before we came back for the second day of hearing. I took Dr. Narayan's deposition, and I know that that's in the record because it was filed by the respondent. And I asked him very pointedly, does depression, as you've diagnosed in Mr. Cafanteras, cause him to lie, to cheat, to steal? No. Did it cause him to do any of these things to his clients? No. So we don't have a mental illness cause to what this gentleman did. And it's an after-the-fact effort to try to get some kind of mitigation here. The reason Dr. Darnell did not testify, why his deposition was excluded, was because there was a separation of witnesses. And knowing that, Mr. Cafanteras gave him Narayan's deposition, said, read this before you testify. So the board, on our request, excluded that testimony because it was tainted. It was a direct violation of the order of separation of witnesses. The board, I think, made an effort to sincerely listen to whatever mitigation evidence that Mr. Cafanteras wanted to offer. And in fact, he brought in several of his sons who appear to be fine young men, and they testified grandly for their father, and they were complimented by Judge Bressler for sure, and I think several of the other members. But it doesn't explain any or provide any information for the mitigating factors that are required under 10B. He had a prior disciplinary offense. He had a dishonest and selfish motive. He was taking money from multiple clients. There was a pattern of misconduct in the Heasley case. This went on for close to a year, and he was doing it even while we were trying to investigate. I think that's why we didn't get the records we asked for, because it would have become apparent very quickly what was going on.
Let me stop there, Mr. Rudloff, excuse me. Mr. Hollister urges us to impose an indefinite sanction rather than a disbarment because the respondent is now in OLAP and he's being treated and so forth, and that we won't know until sometime in the future whether he's competent to return to the practice of law, and that we should not give him the so-called death sentence, professional death sentence now. What's your response to that argument?
My response, Your Honor, is that what he did was not caused by any mental or physical affliction or problem. He's admitted that in his own testimony. He says, I'm not mentally ill, I'm not substance addicted. And the professional, the psychiatrist, said it didn't cause him to do these things. He may have depression, he may have other issues, but they didn't cause him to lie to this court in that affidavit. They didn't cause him to take the Williams estate money, which, by the way, that estate is not whole. We don't have full restitution because it lost 14 months of income on that $25,000 he took. So it's disingenuous to say that restitution's been made when that money would have been in an investment account earning something additional for the heirs of that estate. It's also interesting that the argument we were hearing before the panel, and I think it's in the record, well, I stole it because if I didn't, one of the heirs was going to take it. I don't understand that logic, but that seems to be the type of mindset that this gentleman has. And quite frankly, I don't think that's the type of mindset that members of our profession should have when they're serving the public. The respondent's conduct throughout the last couple of years, since he was initially suspended, demonstrate a pattern of legal practice, demonstrate a pattern of conducting one's life that simply is not within the parameters of what our profession requires of all of us. I think it's very telling if you have the opportunity, several spots in the record, Judge Bressler made this comment to Mr. Cafanteras. Mitigation starts with you. It comes from you. And I haven't heard mitigation from you. I haven't heard explanations from you. I've been waiting now for two hearing days about why you stole money from your clients. You didn't answer in the deposition, and I haven't heard it in two full days of hearing. How do you assure the Supreme Court that this won't happen again where you take money from clients? He says, my kids are grown, so they're through school. I don't see this coming up again. Not one word that he learned anything.
So if he still had young children, he'd still be doing what, that's the implication, I guess you're saying.
Judge, I don't know why he did what he did, but that was the explanation. Mr. Wittenberg, who was the panel chair, said, I've listened a lot to you in the first day of hearing, this day of hearing, but I haven't heard you say yet I'm sorry or showing remorse for what you did. Only after that prompting, Mr. Cafentera said, I'm sorry, you have no idea how sorry I am. Wittenberg, are you saying you're sorry, but you're not going to be able to practice law for a period of time? I'm sorry if I embarrassed the profession. I'm sorry about that. Not I'm sorry for what I did. Member Jacobs, what can you do to show remorse for a woman who's dead, whose money you stole? She was so vulnerable. The answer, I tried to rationalize. I'm trying to think in my own mind, is there something good that came out of that? Is there something good that came out of that? Judge Bressler, you can be sorry that you gave the bar a black eye, but the most important question is your own personal understanding of right and wrong in taking it to begin with, as a lawyer and as an officer of the court. Answer, I've been trying to understand. To this day, he's never said that he does. In the closing of our case before the board, Mr. Ambrosi made a very distinct comment, and I think probably one that's been around for a long, long time, but fool me once, shame on me. Or shame on you, excuse me. Fool me twice, shame on me. We're asking that this court not be fooled a second time. The Trumbull County Bar Association respectfully requests that you adopt the recommendation and the findings of the Board of Commissioners and permanently disbar Mr. Cafentera from the practice of law in the state of Ohio.
Thank you, Mr. Redlove. Mr. Hollister, you saved a little less than 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think it's important that both here before you on his feet and in the brief, Mr. Redlove's basis for saying there was no cooperation is in large measure the fact that there were no stipulations entered into before the hearing before the panel. There is, of course, no requirement that there be stipulations. In this case, Mr. Redlove drafted stipulations, which he proposed, and those were not accepted and were not signed by both parties because he was insisting that the respondent stipulate to Mr. Redlove's arguments as to the meaning of the facts in addition to the facts that occurred. Mr. Cafentaras has never denied the facts.
Counsel, was there an immediate disclosure and turning over of the records to the accounts that were requested in order to further the investigation of the relator?
I would agree with Mr. Redlove that there appears to be a lack, that some of these records were simply not in existence.
Disclosed that I don't have the records, so let's move on to the next, or was there, you know, a year, I think I heard him say that there was a year almost that transpired. And then what was turned over was impossible to decipher.
Well,
is that inaccurate? Is that not true?
I think that's correct, and that would certainly be a factor to be considered if it were to transpire someplace down the road, the court were confronted with an application for readmission. I'm quite confident that there would have to be some requirement to put the court's mind at ease for training, mentorship, evaluation of counting records, you know, some kind of restriction on that area of practice. There are places where that's imposed on all lawyers. You know.
But would you acknowledge that failure to turn over records for the relator's ability to examine the problem in detail before it is an example of failure to cooperate?
If the records don't exist, I would not call it failure to cooperate. Failure to maintain the records is certainly a problem that I would expect this court to take into account
in any future application for readmission, and that would have to be addressed in some way by, as I say, by training, by demonstrating concern for an ability to comply with those requirements to maintain records, and so on.
Need to sum up, Mr. Hollister.
I'm sorry?
You need to sum up. Your red light's been on.
The I disagree with Mr. Rudloff's position that the OLAP program is a simply after-the-fact tactic to fool the court. You have before you relatively recent reports from OLAP. I think the only fair way to read them is that Mr. Kafantaris has been regularly and faithfully going through the treatment program. We are not dealing here with a case of drug addiction where somebody's stealing drugs from a police evidence locker or stealing money to go out on the street corner and buy drugs. I think it's that type of situation that's addressed by the rubric caused him to commit. What we're dealing with here is a mental condition that renders somebody less than fully able to deal with the demands of everyday life.
Sum up means a brief statement. Your time is up.
And so I think the psychologist's, Dr. Darnell's conclusion, he's the one who testified and Ryan's the one who was excluded, that this is the condition he diagnosed is consistent with the behavior is the most that can be said in this kind of a case and should be treated as a mitigating
Thank
condition.
Thank you, Mr. Hollister.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.